Morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument, United States v. McMillian. Mr. Henderson.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. There are two main attacks on the judgment below, one to the conviction on four of the seven counts, and one on the sentencing errors that occurred. I'm going to focus primarily on the sort of federalism concerns that I identified in the brief as to the convictions, and then on the ex post facto violation that happened at sentencing. This statute is fairly recent in terms of federal law. It was enacted in 2000, and it intrudes upon an area of traditional state authority, local criminal activity. When Congress enacts a law that does such a thing, the Supreme Court has just told us last term that we need a clear indication from Congress that it actually intends to do so. So as a means of clarifying our argument, this is not an argument that this is somehow unconstitutional or beyond the power of Congress to enact. The argument is that Congress enacted a certain law that does not reach as far into local criminal activity as the government seems to think it does. You find that in the statutory language. The language requires a mental state that the person knows that another person will be caused to engage in a commercial sex act. The language isn't terribly clear because it's written in the passive voice, but what it appears, comparing that to, say, the state of Wisconsin statute, is that's the federal government saying, this is not just to reach prostitution generally. This is not a general anti-pimping statute. This is a statute that really is going after the evils of what Congress called a form of modern slavery. This is going after forced prostitution, prostitution against the will of the prostitutes. We cited to a law review article, which I think gives a good explanation of what's in the congressional record. And we've cited to the congressional record as well. And the record is replete with stories of what Congress really intended to target, and that is luring women in, promising them, come to this state, come to this country. We'll get you a good job, good legitimate job. The women show up, and they're forced to become prostitutes. You see the stories where if they decide to run or flee, their passports are taken from them, they'll be subject to...
Where is the, in your view, the limit of the congressional intent? I gather you think it covers international matters. Does it cover interstate matters?
Absolutely.
Any intrastate matters?
Absolutely. Any interstate matters.
Where's the line?
The line is, I think, a voluntariness line, and that's what you see in the language and what you see in the
with
congressional
respect
record.
To adults, that's what you see.
I think with respect to both, because for both adults and minors, there has to be something that causes them to engage in a commercial sex act.
Nice.
Now, Congress doesn't tell us exactly what that is.
Isn't the same thing alleged here that would apply to people in other countries, that is, a nicer lifestyle, all the types of things we're talking about here isn't applied to both the rationale, the reasoning for getting into prostitution that they're...
Right. And so the difference is whether that's a choice that you make or whether it's forced upon you. So, for example, in Nevada, people decide to become prostitutes. Now, in the state of Wisconsin, that's illegal. But what you see in this record is there's not this sort of deception. It's not Mr. McMillian saying, come be with me. I'm an aspiring rap star, and you can just be a groupie. He is very explicit with each of them, and he walks them through the steps. Here's what's going to happen. And they all understood because, he's a pimp. He's an aspiring rap star that if they want to be with him, then that's the people he associates with.
Did it start out that way?
Well,
was that the first one?
Right, with Jessica, she started working with him. I mean, she met him, and she wanted to continue to have a relationship with him. And at some point in their relationship, he said to her, listen, you should start stripping. You should you know, do some prostitution dates. And she had a choice, and she identified that, and she said, well, I really wanted to stay with him. I was in love with him. And so I thought, well, you know, if it's good for us, then, you know, I guess I'll do it, even if, you know, I kind of feel bad doing it. That's a choice. That may be a very difficult choice, but it doesn't negate the voluntary nature of the choice.
Mr. Henderson, this statute, unlike the statute in Boyd, clearly does invoke the commerce power. Doesn't that make a difference in the probable scope of Congress's intent?
I don't think so. Again, we're not attacking the constitutionality of this. And
no, but that is indicative of their intent. They were apparently trying to prescribe something that, in the Congress's judgment, affected interstate commerce.
Right. No, that's true. It's certainly a difference. I mean, Bonds didn't reach the issue of the constitutionality, and what it reached, I think, was saying when the rule from Bond is when Congress intrudes on what is traditionally a state criminal matter, we need a clear indication that that's what it intended to reach. So Congress invoking the commerce power, I think, really is just a source of jurisdiction. I don't think it's saying we want to affect all prostitution. And one of the reasons I think that is because there was a bill in the House in 2007 that did seek to basically federalize criminal prosecution of prostitution, and it failed with the Department of Justice's, you know, rallying against it. So that the introduction of that bill tells me two things. One is that this statute clearly was not seen as sufficient by Congress to attack all prostitution, all commercial sex acts. And it also means that we don't have that law. This is not a prostitution statute. This is a sex trafficking against the will of the victims statute. The case that I think applies Bonds to best to a similar set of facts is the Sixth Circuit's case in Toviave, where it's under Section 1589, the forced labor statute, which was enacted at the same time. And what the Sixth Circuit says is, yeah, we've got reprehensible conduct here. We've got child abuse. We've got you know, forcing children to do a lot of work. But it's not forced labor. There's a difference in quality between the type of statute and the penalties associated with that statute that Congress enacted, and the local criminal activity that's happening here.
But the range of this activity was not. It affected Wisconsin, Minnesota, and it used Craigslist, which is pretty widespread.
Right.
I mean, it isn't just a local whatever the city was.
Right. Well, and now the majority of the dates were done, you know, locally in terms of...
Right, they were, but...
Right.
But they did spread quite a wide...
Right. And again, there's no question that Congress has the power to regulate this.
Well, why wouldn't your argument apply to the Mann Act?
Well, because I think there Congress gave a clear indication that we are seeking to criminalize this. It's whether there's a clear indication that Congress is seeking to criminalize a certain range of conduct. And so, right, with, you know, distribution of drugs, that happens at the local level every day. But Congress has clearly indicated...
What's the difference in language between this and the Mann Act?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I'd have to look that up.
Well, I don't understand you. What's the difference between this law and the Mann Act?
My assumption about the Mann Act is that within the Mann Act, and if you look at the congressional record, Congress clearly intends to criminalize what is local conduct. It's the clear indication that I'm looking for in this record that I don't see. And the Supreme Court has just said we need that
well,
clear
you're
indication.
You're being awfully vague about it.
Right, and that I apologize for that. I don't know what the record is in the Mann Act. I'd have to look that up. I think the Supreme Court really is taking the federalization of criminal law, though, very seriously.
All this is about is applying standard, you know, criminal principles about prostitution to situations in which the prostitute is transported across state lines.
No, I don't think that's true. I think that's the man. I mean, that's section 2422.
So what's the difference here?
The difference here, this deals with forced prostitution. So this
this is your notion of cause as force?
And that's the notion, yeah.
Yeah, but that's not persuasive. That's not what cause means. Cause doesn't mean exert force. Cause means bring about a result.
Right, and so in the statute, it's not...
I mean, obviously in the Mann Act, the pimps are causing the prostitute to cross state lines.
Okay. That's
cause.
Right.
It's not force.
Right, and again...
So why is the cause here? Why do you equate cause to force?
Well, I actually don't equate it to force. I may have misspoke. I equate it to voluntariness. Because if cause implies an external actor or some sort of effect, and so presumably just engaging in a commercial sex act by a prostitute, nobody's causing the prostitute to engage in the commercial sex act. I mean, I suppose, you know, you show up at the date and the John gives the money.
I don't understand that. You hire a person to be a prostitute, you're causing her to be a prostitute.
Right, and the difficulty I see with that interpretation, I understand it, but is that it basically makes a federal crime out of all prostitution.
Well, that's what the Mann Act does.
Right, and in this
you
case...
You haven't told me what the difference is between this and the Mann Act.
No, and that's due to my ignorance. I simply don't have the
well,
distinction.
Well, that's rather critical.
Yeah.
Because no one is questioning the constitutionality of the Mann Act.
Right, right. Well, and we're not challenging the constitutionality of
yes, I know, but you think it's unconstitutional or unintended or something that there's no requirement of force. But there's no requirement of force in the Mann Act. So I
right.
don't know what the difference is.
Right. Well, I would just say our argument is not that our argument is that this addresses involuntary prostitution. That's what Congress intended. And I think that the court should read this statutory language to affect Congress's intent. But that's my reading of Congress's intent. I want to briefly talk about the ex post facto violation here. On the main count that really drove the guidelines was based on conduct that was retroactively increased in punishment. And this court has upheld the one-book rule in cases where offenses are grouped, but this is very similar to the Fletcher case that just came out when we have ungrouped counts. So I guess unless the court has questions, I'll rest on my briefs, but I think that there is a serious problem with using enhanced guidelines on counts that finished before the guidelines were amended to drive what became a 30-year sentence.
How do the circuits line up on that issue right now?
Well, I think we cited in our brief, I think it's either the First or the Second Circuit has said, yeah, the one-book rule is fine in accordance with this court's statements in Hallahan. But again, those have to do with grouped counts rather than ungrouped counts, and this court has always held that the grouping is what gives notice to a defendant that he may be subject to a higher penalty. Here, well, the counts weren't.
Was
grouped.
There a Supreme Court Pew versus the United States which found them retroactive?
Right, exactly. So Pew says you can't apply guidelines retroactively.
Right.
The question is, though, when you have conduct that straddles the line, if they're grouped, this court has said you can increase them retroactively. That was Hallahan. But if they're not grouped, Fletcher says we've got problems. We've got ex post facto problems. So I'll reserve the rest.
You said grouping gives notice?
That's what the court has held.
Well, that's ridiculous, right?
I
do
think
these people know about grouping?
I agree with that statement, but it's to the extent we're bound by precedent, that's what the court has said. So, but there was no grouping here. So I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Henderson. Mr. Wall?
Good Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Henderson. To answer the court's question asked several times, difference between this statute, 1591, sex trafficking of children, or by force, fraud, or coercion, in comparison to
the children.
That's a
you use that word a lot in your brief.
It's the title of the statute.
These are not children. 16-year-olds are not children.
That's true. They're minors. The statute is called sex trafficking of children or by force, fraud, or coercion. I agree with you. They're not children. Many of them are pretty mature. But that also gets to a response I want to make. First of all, going back to the Mann Act, the difference, I think the court understands what the difference is. The Mann Act is simply the transportation of one person across state lines for the purpose of prostitution or illegal sexual conduct. This statute is different, obviously. This statute has to do with the exploitation of other human beings through the breaking down of their free will. And if it's an adult, we look for something like force, fraud, or coercion, or a combination of those. And that, of course, is breaking down the free will. That's getting rid of the voluntariness of the conduct, which distinguishes it from the Wisconsin statute. If we're talking about minors, whether we're talking about 12-year-olds whom I've interviewed, 14-year-olds, 16 or 17-year-olds, we're essentially saying they don't have the ability to consent to this type of conduct. And whether we want to get into early brain development or whatever we want to get into, that I believe is the rationale behind this. It's my belief in looking at the congressional record and reviewing appellant's brief, which is, I believe, an excellent brief, that all these horrors that Congress was looking at were really the trigger that finally caused Congress to act in this area and to wade in with this statute, which has been amended about four different times, each time making it more clear, more strict, broader, with heavier penalties. So that's really what this is about. And I think this statute is much different, much more distinct than that which the appellant is talking about in Boyd, where we're talking about a chemical weapon and essentially just chemicals smeared on an opponent's door frame, and the prosecutors clearly overreaching and using the chemical weapon statute. The Jones case having to do with arson, where the statute just didn't apply. It was not an impact on interstate commerce. And even the Toviavi case having to do with child abuse, again, it's another case in which the Supreme Court said the facts don't fit the statute. Here we have a plain and simple statute, and the words couldn't be any simpler. The use of the words force, fraud, both of those have their dictionary meaning. Coercion has essentially a dictionary meaning and is also defined by the statute. These are very plain and simple things. So I think Congress, whether it's through the Commerce Clause or just through the plain, simple wording of this statute, clearly meant this to apply to conduct just like Tyrone McMillian's here, where he is trafficking these young ladies in the sex trade through the use of interstate facilities, the internet, taking them across state lines for the purposes of prostitution. And it's certainly in the case of Jessica, lying to her and leading her on and selling her a dream for more than 3 years until she finally just wised up. And then the other three being minors, where we really don't need to prove that, but it actually did occur, although it wasn't charged that way. So
well, I think these could have been charged as state crimes, could they not?
They could have been charged under the state statute. The minors could have been charged under a state statute, solicitation of a child for prostitution. The adult, Jessica, would have to have gone under the state pimping and pandering statute, which is a wholly different animal than what we're talking about here. Pimping and pandering in Wisconsin, and that statute doesn't exist anymore. It was absorbed into the new human trafficking statute earlier this year, 2014. Pimping and pandering has to do with, pimping means taking a sex worker to a customer for the purpose of a sex act. Pandering means taking a customer to a sex worker. Anyone call them prostitutes. Let's call them a sex worker. I don't like using the word
prostitute.
That's
Wisconsin, right?
That is in Wisconsin, yes. I don't like using the word prostitutes because I learned that they're prostituted.
We want to be politically correct. Right?
No, I want to, that too, but I want to call it what it is because 9 out of 10 of these females has a pimp behind them who's pulling the strings and doing much more than that. So that's why I would use the word sex worker. In terms of...
But is this a general push, I mean, to federalize what had been for years, forever, thought of as local crimes? I mean, prostitution, for example.
Well, we've seen federalization of local crimes coming since the 90s, just a wave of it. And whether this is part of it or this is just a recognition that it's really going on. I mean, the cultural awareness of sex trafficking, whether it's of children, of adults, and how they get into this predicament, I think it's becoming more and more and more aware. People are becoming more and more aware of it, which is a good thing.
I mean, it's hard to say. Part of the impetus was the horror stories of overseas people being brought in that fit this.
Sure, and those are horror stories. And in my mind, that's the trigger for Congress to say, look, we need to do something. And they draft a statute that clearly applies to intrastate, interstate domestic sex trafficking, which is what we have here. The ex post facto issue is an interesting one. The court has handed down several cases since the Pew case, and I look at these cases. Judge Posner stated, and I was trying to write it down quickly before I walked up here, that using grouping as the core of notice is ridiculous. I would agree with that. To me, notice needs to be transaction-based. And what I mean by transaction-based is I'm talking about a continuing course of conduct that straddles the change in the guideline. I'm talking about multiple crimes that are similar in nature that an individual continues to commit, whether they fall under the 2D1.2 grouping provisions or not. I'm talking about a continuing course of conduct in which an individual who engages in ongoing criminal conduct, almost like a one-man conspiracy, or even better, a racketeer. In this case, we could easily say Tyrone McMillan was involved in a racketeering activity from the beginning of the time he recruited Jessica and then the time he had the 3-4 minors until Jessica left. That's an ongoing course of identical conduct. And I don't think there's any ex post facto problem in using the amended guidelines, the post-November 1st, 2007 guidelines. I don't think the idea of grouping, going under a guideline, 3D1.2, answers the question.
But that has to do with the conduct straddling both of them.
Well, if it straddles, that's not an issue. What we have here is we have Jessica straddles, and then we've got 3 minors who don't straddle, and what do we do with them now? Do we stick with the one book rule? If we do we go with the pre-amendment guideline, or do we go with the post-amendment guideline? And that's the dilemma this court faces. I urge the court to go with the post-amendment guideline because, again, this should be transaction-based, not dependent on how the guidelines allocate these different crimes. Rather, what's the transaction here? That to me is the core inquiry. And the transaction here with McMillan is unbroken pimping and exploitation of females and putting them into the sex trade. And that's what I think is should be looked at. Again, a one-man conspiracy, or even better, essentially an uncharged racketeering enterprise.
Because I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about the conditions of supervised release, even though they're not challenged. So the judge, in his sentencing statement, mentioned four or five of these. That's all he said. Now, there is, however, in the written judgment, there are 20 conditions of supervised release imposed. Now, where did that come from?
Your Honor, I don't know where that came from, and if he didn't hand those down to Mr. McMillan in person, I think there's a problem with those.
Excuse me?
I think if he did not tell Mr. McMillan, these are your conditions of supervised release, I think that we've got a problem with those. I haven't done the research on that issue, but obviously he should have been told that in open court, along with the rest of his sentence.
I'm troubled also by the fact, this comes up in other cases as well, the printed form, which the AO sends everybody, it lists 13 conditions of supervised release, but the actual guidelines list 15 conditions. And I don't know, and 14 and 15 are not on the printed form. There's something very peculiar about that.
I would agree.
Okay.
Any other questions regarding these issues? Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ball. Mr. Henderson, do you have anything further? I was surprised you didn't challenge the conditions of supervised release, because according to the printed sentence, the judgment, he's subjected to 20 conditions of supervised release, which come into force, you know, when he's 60 or so.
Right.
In addition, of course, he'll be a registered sex offender with all that stuff. So why should he, after a 30-year sentence, be subjected to 20 conditions of supervised release on top of all the sex offender registration requirements? He's not also, you know, this is not a case where, so far as it appears, it's not a case about pedophilia or anything like that. How likely is he? He's not going to go back into the prostitution business at the age of 60, is he? I mean, I get it.
Right. And, you know, we didn't challenge them. We thought there were bigger fish to fry, frankly.
Don't understand that. You're not precluded from challenging conditions of supervised release just because they're not the only form of punishment.
Right. Well, and I'll advise him, and certainly at any point a person can move under 3583
to modify
them. I think with the benefit of 30 years of case law interpreting these conditions, it may be an easy modification, I guess, is what I'd say. They weren't really our concern now. I see my time's up, so I'll save my
okay,
comments.
Well, thank you very much, and you're, of course, a public defender, and we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client.